Today's program is brought to you by Happy Chef Uniforms, the perfect style, whatever your recipe. Visit happychef.com to order your free 2018 catalog.
Hey, this is Kat, Communications Director of HRN, here with a preview of Episode 2 of Meat and 3. This week, we're talking pork. We'll learn the best way to make a BLT.
I don't think I've ever successfully made a BLT just because I eat the bacon before any other part.
How pitmasters and restaurateurs are helping put small-scale pig farmers back to work in Alabama.
It's all about money. That's the bottom line.
What pork has to do with economics?
Farmers could be particularly affected by China's threat to levy its own tariffs on pork and soybeans.
And with government.
Basically, all of politics is pork at this point.
So tune in on Friday afternoon for your weekly serving of Meat and Three. And make sure you subscribe to be the first to know when new episodes air.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
I would hear these stories from my friends, like, and not chefs or cooks. Oh, I went to West Africa, I went to Ghana, and I went to slave castles, and I found myself. I'm like, what do you mean you found yourself? Like, yeah, I realized I was something that I never knew I was.
That is Chef J.J. Johnson describing his culinary awakening and his book, From Harlem to Heaven.
And when I went to Ghana and I cooked in Accra, I started to find myself through food. I would start smelling things that I knew the scent. I would start eating things that brought me to remembrance of childhood. It was these big connections that before that 10 years of cooking professionally, nobody was ever telling me about or I didn't understand. So then I was like, okay, how can I broaden this conversation? And
more on that and a lot of other topics this week on Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I'm your host, Andrew Friedman, here with...
Caitlin Friedman.
Here with Caitlin Friedman. Hi, Caitlin.
Hi, Andrew. How are you doing today?
You know how I'm doing.
I know.
I'm going to just briefly explain why this is not going to be our usual ebullient intro. First of all, I just came home from it was actually a wonderful event. At very touching event at the Institute of Culinary Education. We had a panel of legendary chefs and industry people. We had a lot of industry in the audience talking about my book. But it's 11 o'clock at night. And
that's like our special.
I know. It's our time. It's our magic hour. And I'm getting up in 4 hours for a sad reason. I'm going down to Florida. I don't want to violate anyone's privacy. But suffice it to say, I have a relative who had a sudden medical situation, and I'm going down there to be present, supportive. I'm getting up at 3:30 in the morning. I'm taking a 5:45 flight, but we had this intro to do, so here we are. This is what's called being a professional,
or being yourself,
or being meaning me.
No, I'm just saying.
Maybe I should have just not done a show this week?
No, I think you should have done a show.
I already edited the show.
No, I like that it's out there. You are yourself, and that's what's great about you.
But what do you mean by I am myself? Now we're getting into this sticky thing.
It's actually not sticky. Because you're telling everyone what's going on.
Oh, yeah. I just can't.
I know.
I can't tonight. I already did a two-hour talk tonight.
I get it.
Anyway, our guest is Chef J.J. Johnson. J.J., I'm sorry, like you're not getting my usual cheerful self. You've never met J.J.
I've never met J.J.
I had never met J.J. A couple of months ago, I was meeting my friend Anne McBride, and I'm going to give a shout out to Anne McBride. This is actually cheering me up, just the mention of Anne McBride's name.
I've met Anne McBride.
Anne McBride is, I think I'm a pretty good, connector, networker, and all that stuff. and I mean that in the best, most sincere way, but Anne McBride puts me to shame. She knows everybody in the business. She organizes one of the things I was just doing in California, which is a World of Flavor conference at the CIA in St. Helena in the Napa Valley. She's just awesome. And she and I were meeting for a catch-up drink a couple of months ago. And of course, as is often the case when I meet Anne, she's wrapping up a catch-up drink with someone else before our catch-up drink. So on this particular occasion, she was wrapping up a drink with J.J. Johnson, who I've always thought seems like this really nice guy, and people I know love his food. He was the chef at the Cecil up in Harlem. Mm-hmm. And then more recently, he was had a residency, I guess you would call it, at the Chef's Club in downtown Manhattan, which was very successful, so successful that it was actually extended. That was back in the fall. And it was really cute because I had a copy. I had a galley of Chef's Drugs and Rock and Roll, and he had just gotten his book, which came out just a few weeks before mine. And I said, oh, let's be like soccer players where they trade shirts at the end of a match. So Anne took a picture of us holding, I was holding his book and he was holding my book. It was very sweet.
That's so cute.
Yeah. And I said, I'd love to get you on the show. And we finally were able to squeeze it in. We met a few weeks ago. So JJ's without a restaurant at the moment. And my buddy Danny Abrams, who owns, among other things, the Mermaid Inn restaurants, let us come into the Mermaid Inn on the Upper West Side. And we were able to do an interview right there in the dining room, which was great. So that was Danny. Thank you for that. And JJ, so what do we say about JJ? JJ has a book out called From Harlem to Heaven. It's, well, we describe it in the interview, so I won't get into spoiling it now or explaining it now. We get into it very early in the interview. But it's a really wonderful book. He did it with Alexander Smalls, who's his kind of, I think, a culinary mentor to him. We had a great conversation. It's pretty free-ranging. We got into some politics for people who that might be a problem. Consider this a warning. Maybe this isn't your episode. Not too much. But we didn't bother hiding our feelings about the state of affairs in the USA right now. And that's really, I think, all that needs to be said about it, to be honest. I don't know. Does it feel like it gives you enough intel?
Yeah, I think that was good. I think his book sounds great.
His book's wonderful. He's a smart dude. I like him a lot. JJ, you and I need to meet up and have a drink or a meal or something. In any event, that's what this week's show is. I'm going to turn it over to the interview. I have to change the way I do this, Caitlin, because we already, in our New World Order here, the mm-hmm. theme music has already played.
Oh, okay.
So I'm going to just gradually
Get quiet.
Ask you guys to imagine yourselves entering the Mermaid Inn and seeing me and JJ during the quiet of a weekday morning. Staff's not there yet.
Is Danny with you?
Danny's in another room doing interviews. Staff's not there yet. You go into the back dining room. You see us in the corner at a table. We're talking. And with that, maybe you pull up a chair and join us as we start our conversation. Here you go. So, JJ, here we are at the Mermaid Inn. It's not either of our homes. We're squatting. So I feel like you and I could get very deep on several topics, but we don't have a lot of time to do it. We both have places to be today. We squeezed this interview in the midst of our book promotional lives, which kind of overlaps with the rest of our lives.
Yeah. And if I don't put the information in my calendar, or if you don't send me a calendar invite, I kind of forget nowadays. So I'm so happy you texted me last night.
Oh, you're referring to my compulsive habit of confirming.
That was so amazing. I'm going to start doing that with everybody too.
You know, I say this all the time. I was an assistant to the film producer when I was in my 20s, and certain habits just don't go away. If I didn't confirm an appointment for him, it was not pretty.
No, it was not pretty. That was very keen.
So, yes. Okay. First of all, you and I have something in common. We have a couple of things in common, but we both have books out.
Yes.
Can we? Yours came out a little bit ahead of mine.
So mine came out February 6th. It's called Between Harlem and Heaven.
Yep.
Afro-Asian American cooking for big nights, long weekends, and every day, I think. I think I hit that
you on. You got it down. Yeah, my subtitle is a little longer than yours, and I always wonder when I start talking, am I going to screw it up? So, and I have it here. We'll talk about it in a few minutes. But what? My book came out Feb 27th, so we're just like 3 weeks apart. What's the publishing experience been like for you?
It's really different for me. You know, like when I look at, I think I'm, I don't want to say I've mastered like this marketing PR influencer game, but I really study it because nobody teaches you about it.
Yeah.
And I think it's hard when you kind of speak to some of your editors, they don't get it. Like they think the book world is still the book world of what it's always been. Like you need to be here, here, and here. And it's like, no, hold on. Just as much as society changes every day, the book world has changed every day. It's the reason why bloggers can write books now. It's the reason why celebrities can write cookbooks and they're New York Times bestsellers, because they are able to hit a totally different demographic than us, as I call the one percenter of the food world,
right?
Are able to hit. So I think the book that I've been able to develop, I want the mass to get.
Yeah.
And I'm still trying to figure out how to get
it. It's hard,
to get
right? Because so am I. Like, I can get people to listen to this podcast largely through social media. I've never hired a publicist. Heritage doesn't do much. But people have found the show. It's largely been from Instagram.
Right.
I mean, it has. Mine and my guests. Like, that has gotten the word out. And I think word of mouth. It's very hard to make the same thing happen with a book, although I'm not happy you're having that feeling, but you have a bigger following than I do, so I sort of assumed it was taking care of itself.
No, I mean, I look at it on like the distribution numbers. We've done great on distribution, yeah. But I think that my issue is, and I never knew this, like people are really price sensitive.
Mm.
Right, so.
That's interesting.
I think if you make a cookbook that's below $25.
Yeah.
And Amazon, when they sell it for 15,
yeah,
doesn't matter who you are, you'll purchase it.
Right.
When you make a cookbook for $30, $35,
yeah,
and it sells on Amazon for $25,
right,
people have to think about it and say,
yeah,
is this book, am I going to look at this book? Right. So people are really price sensitive to books. So that's another issue I'm trying to figure out.
Yeah, it's also one of the most profound things I ever heard anyone say about where we were headed, and this was like years ago. This was before podcasts even, right? Is there's all these new, you know, there's cable, all of a sudden, you know, there used to be three TV networks. Forget streaming, right? Then there was cable television and that whole world. Then there's all the streaming stuff. Then there's podcasts, right? There's all these different categories of entertainment that didn't even exist before. But the line that I read somewhere said, everybody still only has those 2 hours to give up, you know?
Right.
So I think books kind of, we don't think about it that way, but like it's also the time, you know, and the bandwidth to even notice things today, you know? Like,
yeah.
You know?
I agree with you, you're
fighting for people's attention span.
Yeah, you are. And then when people read your title or look at your book, it's like, does that relate to me?
Right.
Am I going to cook out of that? Am I going to read that book?
Yeah.
I think the best thing I've heard was I did a show in Nashville and the executive producer was like, hey, I've been reading your book like a novel.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's been the goal. Can you tell the world? So it's just something new for me.
Yeah.
I'm going to do more books though.
Yeah.
In my life.
Yeah.
But no, it's been great. Flatiron's done an amazing job. The book came out beautiful.
Yeah, it's very pretty. Well, let's talk about the book for a minute. What was the genesis of the book? I mean, I assume it was the restaurants.
Yeah, the genesis was the restaurant. But I think the grander theme of it was like, okay, when you look at cookbooks on the shelf,
yeah,
and if you're trying to find a book that relates or tells you the story of a certain history and movement of the African diaspora, there's really not much.
Yeah.
And you have books out there that do tell, like Jessica Harris's book, mm-hmm, The Chimamanda Code,
mm-hmm,
Tony Tipton, but there was nothing that actually tells the story. And then has the recipes attached to it to bring it to life.
Yeah.
And that's what we were trying to show people. Like when you think about what, and I mean, number one question I still get, you cook soul food. And I say, well, is that because I'm black?
Yeah.
And that's the main reason, and that's what this book was truly trying to show you, is that there's more than just soul food for the African-American culture.
Yeah. That's really something you felt needed to be conveyed in 2016 or whenever you sold the project.
Yeah, I mean...
Does that make you... I don't know. There's so many things that we still have to deal with in 2018. Like,
I felt like we were going in a great
further
path.
Right. Yeah, you'd think we were further along than this. But before we go any further, though, the African diaspora, this is a term that you make a point in the book of defining. You spend some time on this.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead and explain what that is to people.
So the African diaspora is, it's the makeup of where West African slaves went. Was it 200 years ago? Yeah, 200 years ago.
Ish.
Where they went through unchosen, through slavery.
Yeah.
And when they wherever they went, they impacted the culture through their cooking style, through the seeds or rice that they were bringing. And then they were mixing and mingle with that culture in that area. So, you know, when you think of the African diaspora, you think of the American South, but it's so much bigger than that. Because you're talking about, you know, the coast of Brazil, the Afro coast of Brazil, if you're talking about the Afro coast of Colombia or the Afro coast of Peru or the or the West Indies. We even go in deep, so deep saying, like, you know, the Guinea hen, you would think it comes from France, but it really comes from Guinea. So there's all these things that the African diaspora has touched upon in the world that we were hoping to make eye-opening to people.
Yeah.
That it's a bigger conversation than just the American South.
And where did that, I mean, you mentioned the whole soul food thing a minute ago, but where, what were the seeds of this sort of education, evolution for you? For you as someone who's just interested in food. Again, you write about this in the book. You've been interested, you were interested in cooking and food from an amazingly young age.
Super young age.
Yeah, moments that are almost like, the textbook moment for, you know, standing on a, what'd you say, on a crate?
A milk crate,
A milk crate, with cooking with your grandmother after school when you were supposed to be doing your homework.
Right.
Like, these are like moments that, you know, there's a lot of chefs who have, there's a lot who don't, but there's a lot who have moments just like that in their childhood. So you had, you were cooking always. When did you start to develop an interest in this topic? And how did you go about getting educated on that?
So the interest of the topic came from a man named Alexander Smalls, who brought me awareness to me about the African diaspora, the food of the diaspora. And then I was asked to go cook in Ghana, and that's really where it started. These stories, like I would hear these stories from my friends, like, and not chefs or cooks. Oh, I went to West Africa, I went to Ghana, and I went to slave castles, and I found myself. I was like, what do you mean you found yourself? Like, yeah, I realized I was something that I never knew I was. And when I went to Ghana and I cooked in Accra, I started to find myself through food.
What do you mean by that?
I would start smelling things that I would that I knew the scent. I would start eating things that brought me to remembrance of childhood.
Yeah. You made connections.
It was these big connections that over the before that 10 years of cooking professionally, nobody was ever telling me about or I didn't understand. So then I was like, okay, how can I broaden this conversation? And or brought in my own conversation. It wasn't like I could come back to New York and eat at these restaurants.
Yeah.
So I had to pick up an encyclopedia. I had to do a little bit. I had to go back to places of that I traveled as a kid or where could I travel and afford to travel. So I was going a lot back to the West Indies. So I was connecting these dots through looking at migration. And then the food through that migration. So if roti was coming from India. To Barbados. Okay, now I understand it because I used to grow up on this roti. Now what kind of dips can I put with that roti? Right? Or if it was looking at peri-peri sauce and saying, okay, peri-peri sauce started in Ghana, but it goes to Portugal. Let's look across that line and see what kind of influence was there. And that was really how I was pulling or educating myself about the food of the African diaspora.
Yeah. And when you start doing your own food in a restaurant, okay, and you start calling on these influences, what was your main objective? Like, was were you looking for authenticity? Because your own experience of these things was somewhat limited. You didn't grow up in these places you just named, right? Or were you looking to use those things in a way that was just an expression of your own food? Like, were you happy to sort of riff on these things? Or were you trying as best you could through the counsel of maybe Alexander or somebody like that, like to kind of hit like a really authentic spot? Does that question make sense?
Yeah.
Like, was it more interpretive or was it more sort of so it was almost like, anthropological for you?
It was kind
of
like, oh, wow, I had these peri-peri prawns.
Yeah.
But how can I make it better?
Mm-hmm.
Or how can I use technique? How can I use a technique that I know?
Right.
To make sure this could be executed every day. So I took peri-peri sauce.
Right.
I mean, I took peri-peri made it into a sauce.
Right.
Right. With those ingredients that you saw.
Yeah.
But then what else can I add to it? What citrus can I add to it to make it brighter?
Right.
What can I do to make it nice and balanced?
Yeah.
You know, that's how I was looking at certain dishes.
Yeah.
There were certain dishes I knew I couldn't, I can't do authentic, but I knew I couldn't do in New York.
Yeah.
Because the dining scene always, well, people just want certain things.
Yeah.
And I believe New York is a very picky dining scene.
Yeah.
Like, we're all picky eaters and we don't want to say that.
Well, can I interrupt you? What do you mean by that?
We just
I
know.
I think I know what you mean.
We know
what
we want. Like, New Yorkers really know what we want. Like, certain New Yorkers, when they tell you, you can't sit at the table until it's complete.
Yeah.
You know, or you can't, your reservation at 8 o'clock, but you're not at a complete party. You have to wait for your complete party. Like, what do you mean? I'm here.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Or when I go out to eat, I want to see on the menu salmon, calamari,
roast chicken.
Roast chicken, right? I don't care what it comes with.
That's what you mean.
But I'm, yeah.
Yeah. There's certain things people expect are going to be available.
Right.
How do you feel about that as a chef restaurateur? Like, for example, I was just speaking recently. I was doing a book event, right? And people were asking me about the New York marketplace. And I was like, you know, we all joke about, you know, the kale salad, the avocado toast, the chicken for two. But there's a reason that exists. Those things exist, I think, because the investment is so huge these days. It's a way of hedging your bets. Like, if people, it's kind of a different way of saying what you're saying. It's like, you want to have that. You don't want someone to look and be like, you know, I don't recognize any of this stuff. People need some, it's very easy if you're a quote unquote foodie to get caught up in the new, right? When the fact is there's a, you know, the majority of diners out there. I remember a million years ago, Alfred Portale telling me the number one seller on the Gotham appetizer menu was the garden salad.
I believe it.
And I was like, what?
But it was beautiful. It was still beautiful, right?
But the makeup of it was very traditional. On that menu, there were these things that are now historic, like his tuna tartare or the seafood salad. And I remember him telling me that. And I think about what you're saying. It's, again, like, you would think that it changed, but it's easy to get nearsighted when you do what you do and I do what I do what people want.
And I think, I say this, is like when I went from being at the Cecil to then cooking at Chef's Club, I stopped cooking for myself and I started cooking for the people. So like I my mom goes to eat at restaurants. She always wants chicken every time. I would never put chicken on the menu.
Yeah.
I would put poussin. I would put guinea hen.
Yeah.
You go now, you'll see roasted jerk tamarind chicken.
Yeah.
But it didn't matter. It doesn't matter that it's jerk or tamarind or that it comes with soy braised collard greens and some beautiful puree. People are like, oh my God, it's roasted chicken or it's jerk chicken. I know this.
Yeah.
And then from there as a chef, it's like, okay, can I give you the best jerk and the best chicken.
Okay, now be honest with me. Okay, this is the first time you and I have sat down. When you say you wouldn't have ever put that on your menu previously, okay, is it a grudging thing that you do? Or do you consider, this is a real debate, I think, amongst chefs. I think really right now it's at a moment of change. Is that a grudging thing? Or do you consider that part of the role of being a chef? That give the people what they want.
3 years ago, it was a grudging thing.
Yeah.
Today, no. The real role of a chef is bringing people together to give them happy moments, right? And my job is to make sure that your food, your service, your drinks, your wine list, your music, all that stuff is amazing.
Yeah.
And if I can do that with taking my style of my food, and weaving in those flavors around certain dishes to make sure that people are going to come dine there, and we're able to pay our rent. Pay our checks, people can put their kids through college and all those things, then that's okay, because you can have roasted chicken, you can have the ribeye, you can have a couple of these things that are recognizable, and then you can put some things on the menu that you're like, okay, you know, hopefully somebody will try this, and then this will become the new fab.
So it's a balancing act.
Right.
It's a self-negotiation.
100%.
Right. Okay. And you're happy to do it. You're smiling as you say this. You found your sweet spot on this front.
Yeah, but I also, you know, like I know what people want.
Yeah.
I know, and I don't mean, and I think the style of food that I cook, I'm able to hit a lot of areas of things that people want. Like, I know people want noodles. I know people want dumplings.
Yeah.
I know people want tartare.
Right.
Right?
Right.
I know people want beef.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if it's a short rib or if it's A5 Wagyu. Like, it doesn't matter.
Right. Right. Yeah, I find this to be such an interesting, because I do, you know, I'm obviously older than you are. You know, the chefs that I came up working, collaborating with, almost all of them, even a guy, I never collaborated with him, but even like a guy like Thomas Keller, like,
the dude has fried chicken on his menu.
But it's also give the people what they want. Like, right. If you want a bowl of, like, the famous thing someone once said at the French Laundry to me was, like, you know, if somebody wanted a bowl of, like, cornflakes, though, some, and the market was open down the street, they go get the guy some cornflakes. Like, that was kind of the way I grew up hearing chefs talk, right? Somebody wants a glass of ice with their $500 bottle of red wine, okay. You know,
but I think then that new generation came and was like, no, I'm going to tell you what to do.
Yeah, right. Or also the cooking had become so recognized as an expressive thing that it became, you know, there's the art craft debate, mm-hmm. like what is cooking, right? And I think it became like, no, this is my food. You know, no. I'm not going to alter it. I mean, that is David Chang famously, I think, sambar, right? Like, you know, yeah, we don't alter stuff. We don't do, like, that was, to me, that was kind of a big historical line in the sand.
But yeah, but like, let's take a couple steps back here. You can do that once you are established, right? Because you have something that's supporting you. So
right.
David has a noodle bar.
Yeah.
That, of course, he was doing some things in that noodle bar that were no backs on the chairs, all these things that made moments, right?
Yeah.
But was happening in other places in the world. But when you had that fueling, then you can go and say, all right, screw you all. If you want something you know you like, go eat at over here.
Yeah.
Or if you really want to know who I am, now you can come here.
Yeah.
And I think you're able to do that as you grow as a chef. Or not everybody can do that, but when you get established and you can have that one place where it's truly,
right.
you know, this is who I am and this is how I want you to be.
Yeah.
I still cringe about ice in the glass of wine.
I've heard those stories.
I'd rather chill it for you. Let me chill it for you. I get it colder.
I've heard, right, because it's going to melt. Right. I mean, I've heard these stories. I have become convinced that sort of there is a really good argument for the what I'll call, you know, the younger point of view, because there are so many options today. It is true in New York, you know, like there's certain restaurants, you don't go there for the traditional stuff.
Right.
You've come to the wrong place, you know.
And I won't lower the music for you in the restaurant.
There you go. Right, like that. That's what your restaurant is.
Right. That's who it is. Like, that's the feeling.
Right. Right.
And it's like, hey, if I lower the music for you,
right,
then everybody else in the restaurant is expecting one vibe and now you're altering the vibe.
Yeah.
So I can move your table. I can put you in a different area. Like, I'll try to make it work, but that's the one thing that I try to.
Yeah.
That I stand tall.
Good. about the book, I have a question for you. I hope I can phrase this accurately. When you wrote this book, okay, I mean, we're in New York. This is a very diverse city. What when you think of the audience for this book, who you were writing to, right? Or who you were trying to, was it just the world? Was it any particular ethnic group that you thought needed education? Was it, do you know what I'm trying to say?
So I did it in let's say this. I wrote the recipes for the everyday household person.
Anybody
that can make the recipes. That's how I did that. But when I was writing the book, I wrote it very unapologetic.
You're talking about the essays.
The essays, right?
And so people know there's essays, several essays that are credited to you in the book. Mm-hmm. There's the one big one up front by Alexander
in the book. Yep.
The head notes are mostly in your voice. Yep. Right.
So yeah, I mean, when I wrote the book, no, was it geared towards somebody? No.
Okay.
It was like, this is a book that I believe everybody can have, and the reason of that is like when I cook and you come to the dining room, it's very diverse, right?
Yeah.
The food talks to everybody.
Yeah.
So that's what I was thinking about when I was writing the book. When I was done and I'm on this tour, I'm thinking about who is this book. Who really needs this book?
There you go, right?
And who really needs this book are I come from a blue-collar family. Blue-collared, you know, families that understand struggle, right? That understand what it means to be moved somewhere. What it means to potentially, when I mean move, like you might be living in an apartment, then you can afford a house, then you lost your job, now you're back in an apartment.
Mm-hmm.
What it really means to push against the grain or express yourself where other people don't understand what you're exactly talking about.
Mm-hmm.
These are the universal things about your book.
These are universal things about the book and who I think about. I think about, you know, think about African-American families in Charlotte
mm-hmm.
That shop at Walmart and Target, or maybe they go to their farmer's market or a Kroger, and they're like, I really need a book that talks to me. This is the book for them, right? Mm-hmm. Or that family that lives in Oakland that has the amazing Asian markets around them. And they're like, I know I have a book at home that tells me what to
truly
do. Right,
but they don't know what to do with it.
Right, I don't know what to do with
this. You go in and you're just lost.
This is that book.
Right.
So that's now when I'm out there, I'm thinking about it.
Was this something you came to realize through your interaction with readers and potential readers at events and book, you know, signings and stuff?
With readers, signings, and in social media. Like, I watch young black women doing pop-up dinners with inspiration from the book.
Yeah.
Does
that blow your mind?
And it blows my mind. It's like, hold on, the book really made you do this? Right. And it's like, hey, I'm in culinary school. Nobody talks about this.
Right.
I go to school in Charleston, and now I have something that I can play around with to give me inspiration.
Yeah.
So that's what I think about. And I think, it's, you know, this book is truly the perfect time for us in society. It's really sad to say. I think more than ever, we think about where people are coming from. And we're looking at migration. And when I say that, you know, these travel bans that get put up, people get really upset about it because nobody's ever told anybody they couldn't come somewhere, right? Come to
you. You mean to the U.S.
To the U.S., right?
Yeah. They've told people they couldn't go somewhere, but that somewhere was never here.
It was never here.
Yeah, well, there's that, what's that statue in the... Right. A couple of miles south of where we're sitting?
So...
You're comfortable talking about this? Because this is amazing, right? I mean, this moment we're in is amazing.
No, it's truly amazing, right?
So, I mean, we live in New York. I don't know what it's like for you. I feel very sometimes... I live in Westchester.
Right.
Which is...
I live in Harlem.
Yeah, so I'm a couple miles north of you. But you're in the city. I'm not in the city, but I'm so close to the city. But even when I make the small drive, like it took me 25 minutes to drive to meet you today, okay? Once I'm in the city, I almost feel like I'm in another time. I feel like I'm among people. I know there are people who don't, but and for any listeners who don't agree with this, I'm sorry. I can't. I just can't pretend otherwise or be neutral right now. I can't. If you're in New York City, if you're in Los Angeles, where you're 3,000 miles away from DC, you can almost pretend you're in another time, in another place.
These are true melting pots. Yeah. These are true places of the world.
But the larger thing that's going on in this country is really so antithetical to what you and I were raised to believe.
No, yeah, and you know, I grew up in the Poconos.
Right.
Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
It's not the most diverse place. It got more diverse after 9/11.
Yeah.
If you're not from these big city or what they call liberal America, right?
Yeah.
You're kind of naive to what truly is going on, you know, like, you know, it's just truly sad to say. And that's what this book really represents. It's really showing you that. When you say Afro-Asian, you're like, well, what do you mean Afro-Asian? Well, you had this forced migration of the African slaves, and you had the chosen migration of the Chinese and the Vietnamese that were coming into place to take these jobs that the African slaves weren't doing. Yeah. And what happens? They hang out together, they cook together, they live together, they produce together, and this is what happens. And I think nowadays, you'll see that makeup in places, and if you take, Syria, right? Mm-hmm. Those people are not coming to the United States, they're going to Canada.
Yeah.
5 years from now, you'll see the food makeup in that place change because of Syrians.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
You know, and that's the fascinating part behind it, right? You get this new culture that you never knew, that your kids get to know, and that everybody gets to grow up around, and it's not a bad thing at all. Like a four-leaf clover.
My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
Maybe you're looking for a coat for yourself, or you want a bold look for your staff. You might even need a new style for your restaurant, whether it's modern, industrial, or farm-to-table. Whatever you're looking for, Happy Chef has got you covered. Their wide variety of chef apparel and products are perfect for teams of all sizes and styles. And with the industry's easiest custom embroidery, you can add your logo, name, or fun artwork to many of their other products in minutes. Here's what you do. Visit happychef.com and choose from their incredible selection. With only a couple clicks, you can customize many of their products to personalize your look. Right now, they're even offering free custom logo setup on all orders over $150, a $95 value totally free. Visit happychef.com now to order your free 2018 catalog featuring new styles and incredible comfort. Happy Chef, the perfect style, whatever your recipe.
And we are back, and we will get you back to the rest of our interview with JJ Johnson in just a minute. Caitlin, I'm so punchy. I didn't accidentally call him JJ Abrams in the intro to the show, did I?
I'm so tired. I don't know, but I'm going to say I don't think you would do that.
I didn't do that.
No.
You would have caught that.
Oh yeah.
My God, that would be horrible.
You didn't do that.
Listen, everybody, just a couple of quick reminders. First of all, I have a book, as everyone knows, in wide release, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, How Food Lovers, Free Spirits, Misfits, and Wanderers Created a New American Profession. People are digging the book. If you have not ordered it, it's available every way you can read a book these days. You can get a hardcover, old-fashioned
audio
book. You can get an audio version of it. The guy actually is really good. I don't know if I've said this on the show. This is the first time they'd ever done this with me. The publisher was kind enough to send me snippets. Like, it was like an audition. They sent me snippets of five candidates, and I picked the one I like best, and they hired that guy to read the book. That was cool.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So there's the audio version, and then, of course, you can get it electronically, you know, on your Kindle or however you like to read those. So I'd love for you to get the book and read it. And if you like it, throw us a review on Amazon. And speaking of reviews, as always, if you would be kind enough to review this show on Apple's iTunes store and subscribe to the show at Stitcher or iTunes, I would love that. Caitlin, you know how much I love reviews.
They do make you really happy.
They make me so happy. I have to say, I had a great review this week that I just did not pull off the web before we did this intro. So if you're the person who wrote me that review, it was really nice. I'm going to read it on the next show. We usually do that here.
Mm-hmm.
And just with everything going on, I failed. I'm sorry. I'm trying to let go of my perfectionism these days. It's between perfectionism and not having a show on the air this week.
It's between those two.
Yes. So I opted to have a show on the air this week. So I will do that next week. Also, I've been trying to push people to follow us on the various social media that we have. People are definitely more and more following us at Chef Podcast on Instagram. Again, the handle is at Chef Podcast. Twitter is like moribund. Do you know what moribund means? Almost dead.
You think Twitter's almost dead?
No, I think the Twitter account for this show
is almost dead.
It's just not happening.
Yeah, because everyone on Instagram?
Everyone's on Instagram. I think I just got in too late.
Yeah.
You know, this account just got started back in the fall, I think, for a new Twitter account. It's just not happening.
Hmm.
But if you guys want to prove me wrong, I'll leave it up for another week. It's also at Chef Podcast there. And we do have a Facebook page. It's mainly just, I don't kill people with a lot of posts. It's just so you can follow the show and know when there's a new show up.
Mm-hmm.
And also sometimes speaking gigs and stuff like that. That's all. It's not like a direct mail thing where you give your email address and all of a sudden you're getting three things a day. I'm pretty selective. So I'd love if you followed us somewhere. And Kate, mm-hmm. I don't know that I have anything else to say in the mid-show break.
You can just go back to the interview.
I think we can go back to our interview.
Okay.
Okay. So with that, everybody, I'm going to return you to the rest of my conversation with the wonderful JJ Johnson. Here you go. So, a question for you following up on what we were talking about before the break. You know, you were just talking about these cultures coming together, and you were talking about stuff that happened a long time ago. As a student of this stuff, did you ever have moments where, like I just went through the experience of writing a book about the 70s and 80s, right? And once in a while, there'd be moments, like I'd be walking in lower Manhattan, or I'd be walking around San Francisco, and I'd almost feel like I could feel what it was like at this other time that I was researching, you know? Did you ever have moments when you were doing your research or you were traveling, you were hearing stories, you were hearing the origin of dishes, and something kind of came alive for you in a certain way?
Or
that you all of a sudden felt like you connected to it in a way that went just beyond, you know, words on a page or something somebody told you?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the connecting of food for me when I was home, when I call New York City home, was definitely like Little West Africa in Harlem on 116th and between Frederick Douglass and Adam Clayton Powell. I think my biggest eye opener was like when I really traveled to Singapore.
Yeah.
And you think you're going there for the Southeast Asian food, and you get there and it's Malay, Chinese, and Indian. And you're like, well, how did this happen?
Uh-huh.
But when I travel, I look at everything through the West African lens. Or when I was in Israel, in Jerusalem, and I was like, I'm at the quarters, and I'm in the Muslim quarter, and I'm like, this feels like, or I'm over here, I'm like, hold on, this feels like I've had this.
Right.
This reminds me when I was in Ghana. Yeah. How did this happen?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Nobody talked about this.
Right.
And those moments made me believe in what I was cooking even more.
Mm-hmm.
And I think made me start to believe that I was cooking the food of the people.
Mm. That's interesting.
Right? So the food that I'm representing are these people of these melting pots.
Yeah.
But when you say melting pots, nobody really knows what you're talking about either, right? Because you do. But, you know, there's these real melting pots that exist that are they are really the people, right? They are these cultivated, colonized communities that then come together.
Yeah. How important is smell to you?
Oh, amazing. And I learned that when I was in Ghana. Like, I never used to cook with making sure that when the dish came to the dining room, it would smell. It was always appearance, right?
Yeah.
So my hot dishes always want some type of scent to it. So like you're sitting down and you're talking to somebody like, what's that? That smells amazing. Oh, I want that.
Yeah. I remember years ago, somebody telling me, it was when I used to do, before I was lucky enough to make a living as a writer, I was a marketing guy and I worked for a famous coffee company and they were one of my clients. And somebody there, one of the roasters said to me, you know, smell is the most powerful trigger for memory.
Truly is.
And I had never realized that, but that, it, you know, when you were just talking, I thought of that because I've had moments, I mean, sometimes something will just hit me. I don't even know what it is. And I'll remember literally something from like when I was 6 years old riding a bike in Florida. I mean, literally, you're what?
It's right there. It's like in that part of your brain. That
No, but it's like it activates. It's an amazing trigger.
But it's an amazing feeling. In a great way. And you know, that. You talk about that. That's what I'm trying to give you in my cooking. These scent elements to bring you back to a place.
Yes.
In your hood, childhood.
Yeah.
Or to then say 5, 10 years, 20 years from now. Oh wow, I smelled this. I remember when I was with JJ.
Uh huh.
Who was JJ? Oh, he was cooking at this restaurant, and this is what I was smelling.
Yeah, it's amazing stuff.
But think about it. Hold on.
Yes.
Think about it. At Alex Supek's restaurant now, he has the tortilla smell.
Yes.
Blowing in front of you.
You're talking about the one on 53rd Street?
On 53rd Street when you open the
doors. I just had lunch there 2 days ago. Right? You can, on the right kind of a day, you can smell it from the corner. He's mid-block on 53rd Street. Last year when I went there for the first time, I was coming off Madison Avenue, and I said to this friend of mine, I said, oh my God, you can smell the tortillas from here.
It's genius.
It's unbelievable. It was a late summer day. It was like September. And late September, it was quiet. You know, it was pretty quiet in the city. It was a still night, you know, not a lot of wind.
Right.
And it was just, you could like follow your nose to that restaurant, which was an amazing thing to say in the concrete, you know, canyons of New York City. That's so funny you just mentioned that. I just had lunch there the other day. I think this, I mean, he's
amazing. Good. He's doing good stuff there.
He's a smart guy.
But hold on, let's talk about that too.
Oh, yeah, so you wanted to, yes, go.
But on a different route, he's also figured out that Midtown is missing cultural food.
Mm,
and people are craving cultural food.
Yeah.
And that's another reason why he's on, not that, that's not the only reason, his food is phenomenal, but people want that.
Yeah. For people who don't know, by the way, Alex Stupak, who was the first ever guest on this show, episode one.
I didn't know that.
If people want to hear it, there's I was terrible on the first episode. My introduction is so horrible. But Alex was brilliant. It was a 90-minute interview. It was really great. And we talked a lot about that restaurant. But for people who don't know, he started downtown Manhattan when he started doing his version of Mexican food. And then he took a huge gamble. He opened this very large, fancy's too strong, but a nice Midtown serious restaurant with very elegant service, some tableside finishing elements, and you know, it is funny. I just had lunch the other day, and you get like there's people doing like a quote unquote power lunch.
Yep.
And there's people who are like in and out in 40 minutes, and the tortillas for him, that's like his version of a bread program, and they're omnipresent. They show up throughout the entire meal.
So I like to go there and get inspiration because he takes a tortilla really seriously. I take roti really seriously.
So you see that connect. Have you guys ever talked about that?
No, we're friends, but we've never talked about it in
that's
that
detail. That's interesting. That's the way you look at roti.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's,
you know, I call those breads the grandma breads.
Right. Right. I love that. Yeah. Well, you say in the book that now your generation of chefs are cooking the grandma food.
Yeah. Yeah. People, I mean, who you don't want to, I want to cook just as good as my grandma cooks.
Yeah.
Right? That's who I want to be.
But that's also what people crave, right?
And that's like, what people crave, right?
This is another conversation I've had recently. People do not, I don't think civilians understand this about chefs, right? Even people who, you know, operate, whatever you want to call it. We need a new word for it. Molecular, modernist is pretty good. Avant-garde, whatever you want to call that whole style. Those people don't get off work and go eat that food. That's not what they're making at home.
No.
They're going out for tapas. They're going out for Mexican. They're going out for bar food. I mean, that's what they're eating, the same stuff everyone else eats and most cooks eat, that I think.
Right. When you go out for late night eats, you ain't going to, you may go to Blue Ribbon, but you're not going to like eat avant-garde at 12 a.m.
No.
in the morning, right?
That's when you're craving.
You're craving something.
You know, that stuff to me, and there's a place for it. I think it exists to be discussed, to be thought about, to, you know, almost like art. That's that conversation again. So totally different direction, because before we run out of time, we were texting about getting together, and you said, you know, I'm not in a restaurant right now, right? This is always, to me, a fascinating moment in the life of a chef, because your guys' lives are so normally, wherever you're working, your whole lives are kind of centered around this very demanding work, the rhythm of a day, the hours of being a cook or being a chef. What's this period of time like for you? Has it been?
My rhythm is different.
Right, but is that
I like that?
Have you enjoyed it?
I enjoyed it.
I know people
in
who've
beginning.
Been tortured by it, and I know people who have enjoyed the breather. Or the change of pace, to put
it in a different
way.
You know, my rhythm right now is talking to investors.
Yeah.
You know, trying to get these pennies, get these dollars, get a check signed.
Yeah.
And it's different for me. I've never done that before. Nobody's ever taught me how to do that.
Yeah.
Nobody's opened up their Rolodex to me.
Yeah.
You know, it's really like banging down doors. Like, I know you have money. Let's talk.
Right.
I'm not going to rob you, but let's talk.
Is that hard for you to do? Or
in the beginning, it was hard. Now it's just like I'm so used to it that I'm like, I can shoot you an email. I know what to kind of say. But I think the biggest thing is, you know, every investor you talk to wants something different.
Mm.
No, it's not like, well, yeah, we get it. We want this. Everybody wants something different.
Mm-hmm.
Some people want to make you feel like you're on Shark Tank. Other people want to just say, oh, I get it. I believe in you.
Right.
This is what I want to give. What are you going to give?
Right.
It's taking me a little bit longer than I expected myself to raise money.
Yeah.
I thought I'd be able to raise $500,000 a little quicker. I see my friends do it with more money.
Yeah.
But I leave it in God's hands and it will all work out. But
yeah,
I mean, the first 2 months, January, February, I was like, okay, this is cool. I just cook at home for my twins and my wife and it's great.
Yeah.
But now I'm like, all right.
Let's go.
I need to like hear pots and pans.
Yeah.
I need to hear people screaming. I need to hear a micros machine. Like I miss the sound of the POS ticket machine.
Yeah. You're craving that stuff.
Like I crave that stuff.
Yeah.
So hopefully it happens sooner than later.
Yeah. Do you ever dream about that stuff?
Yeah, I dream about the POS system. You like, do. The tickets going
yeah,
off.
Just
yeah,
just being there.
Yeah, like, yeah.
It's amazing.
It's been a good time to spend with my family.
Yeah.
Like, you know, going to Easter and
being around.
Being on the weekends off. But yeah, sometimes on weekends, I'm like, okay, what do I do on Saturday?
Yeah.
You know, what do I watch? Like, this is what you guys do. You watch like TBS and yeah, TNT reruns yeah, and Netflix all day. Yeah. Like, but no, it's been good to go out friends with, you know, being able to get drinks with my friends that work in corporate America.
Right.
So it's been different.
Yeah. What, can you just give people a sense? Well, first of all, who knows? Maybe JJ didn't ask me to do this, but maybe someone will hear this and be intrigued. It's been written about, so I can ask you this, right? What's your concept?
No, my concept's a rice concept. So yeah, instead of a noodle shop, it's a rice shop. So, mm-hmm, and I hate saying this, rice bowls. And all the...
You hate saying that because you feel like bowl, that's been like, so kind of like
trendy, right? Yeah. And then the media goes, oh, another bowl concept, right? And
so what makes this different?
All the rices are going to come from a specific place in the world. So it will break down barriers.
Mm-hmm.
And should make everybody feel super comfortable to come in and dine.
Yeah.
And we all grew up on rice.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the most casual and common ingredient. But this is good rice. This is really good for you. There'll be a dumpling, a roti, some salads,
mm-hmm,
a style of burger, beer, wine, sake, champagne on tap.
And is this a one-off or you're looking to
do? Oh, no. We start with the one.
Of course. But the goal is?
The goal, I mean, I'm not a greedy guy. I mean, if I could get to 10 units
yeah,
over the country,
yeah,
I'd be very happy.
And what category do you put this in? Do you put it in the restaurant, fast casual? Do you not like categories?
So that's very interesting you say that because like I've traveled the world a lot. So when you eat around in the world, most of the time you order at the counter.
Yeah,
right. That's,
right. Yeah.
And the food is amazing, right? Some of our Michelin star restaurants, you order at the counter.
Yeah.
But if you want to call
you
it...
You may even eat in the street in a lot of places.
In the street, right.
Yeah.
Or at the window.
Right. The counter may be the counter like in the cutout of a truck. Yeah.
Exactly. So, yeah, you know, we're not putting it in a category. Good. We're going to kind of see what the consumer calls
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
But there'll be delivery. There'll be a takeout window.
Yeah.
You can sit down.
You're there to serve food.
Yeah. The vibe will be a Caribbean style hut with old school New York City vibes.
Love that. Love that. Okay. So... Can you give me a sense of, and by the way, did I read correctly? You went to culinary school. Yep. You went to the CIA. When I said student before, I don't mean that you've taken courses and all these things. You've made yourself a student.
Oh, no, I understand. Of these things. Yeah.
So, I know I'm saying that for the listeners. But you, am I correct? You're doing this rice concept. You spent time, did you not, with the Anson Mills
Yeah,
people?
I spent some time. Well, so I spent some time with Glenn Roberts over the last 5 years. I was mm-hmm, just down there in Charleston with him again for Charleston Food and Wine. We did an ancient grain tasting.
Yeah.
I've cooked with the rice that's not even on the market that's been smuggled into the country from Togo.
Okay.
Through a rice researcher out of Cornell.
Uh-huh.
I've been to India, to the Himalayas to see rice farms. So I've done some...
Deep
research. Yeah. To make it very cool and fun and accessible.
Right. Yeah, great. I love it. So can you talk for a minute about this process? Because I don't think people have the first clue what it's like to go about trying to put a new venture together. How many people do you think you've either emailed, phone called with, or met with in the months that you've been doing this?
So I'll say
ballpark.
Over the 400.
Whoa. Over what period of time?
Let's say a year.
It's amazing.
Right, what's that, 30 people? That's like one person a day.
It's more than just over one mm-hmm, a day, yeah.
And that's from anybody from an investor
yeah,
to a concept developer to a brand marketer to a designer to a general contractor to a landlord
right,
to realtors yeah, to your partner.
Right.
To
it's crazy. And it's lawyers, like a, it's yeah, like a jackpot machine, right? You're waiting for like the right, you know, the right combination of things to show up in the window. Like you're waiting for the tumbler.
Every day
you're waiting
morning,
for the tumblers to fall into place and like, oh, this is it. Like
right, like, okay, we're ready to go. Okay.
Right. But
you
know,
sign
that
the lease
could be,
and get the check, but right, you don't know when that's
that could
be
a week away. That could be months. I don't want to even I didn't want to say it. Yeah.
But we hope it's done by the end of this month. So
okay. How do you what's
with phase one, and that's just when I mean done and we got a check. We got all the
time,
checks.
It takes time, you know. Years ago, it's amazing now you look back at it. You know, Thomas Keller wanted to buy the French Laundry. It took him 18 months.
right,
to put that together. And I remember him saying to me once, he woke up every day for 18 months thinking somebody was going to take the restaurant out from under him because he couldn't make the deal yet.
Oh, yeah. And I mean,
but that is a hard, is that not a hard mental? How do you stay positive through a period like that? Or are you just naturally positive?
I'm a naturally positive person. I'm a realist. So
yeah.
At any moment, I know something else can occur or yeah. we won't get that person. But I try to stay as positive as I can.
Uh-huh.
I think I've done good in my life to yeah. stay positive.
Yeah.
Like I treat others the same way I want to be treated. So
yeah.
I think that's just like, I love good vibes.
Right.
But yeah, I didn't know. I just learned that 18 months for Thomas. I feel like I'm Thomas right now.
You relate to that when I say that.
Yeah, I didn't. I mean, I could very relate to it. Like, you know, like a year in the game, that's 12 months still
yeah.
going. We'll
yeah.
open up at, if we're lucky, we'll open up at the 18 month mark.
Yeah.
And it is a mental strain, right? Because this is what you truly believe in.
Yes.
This isn't. You're not believing in anything else right now.
Yeah.
I mean, I get calls all the time like, you want to come be a chef at my restaurant? You want to be my corporate chef? And no, I don't want to be any of that.
Right. So you have...
Everything right now is what I believe is food and what I want people to believe in. So if you want to do a full service concept with me, no problem, but I'm a partner. I'm
right.
not just a chef. I'm not going through that again in my life where you put all your sweat and your tears and then somebody comes and says, we're going to go in a different direction.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean you say you're not going through that again?
That's what happened to me at the Cecil. You know,
yeah.
you make this place iconic.
Yes.
It was becoming an iconic restaurant.
Quickly.
Right. Yeah, quickly.
Yeah.
And then one day you're in a meeting like, well, we're going to go in a different direction now. And you're like, what do you mean we're going to go in a different direction?
Right.
But you have no skin in the game. You have no say. You
right.
weren't even part of those conversations.
Right.
You just showed up at the normal weekly meeting, ownership meeting, that you thought you were going to talk about P&Ls.
Right.
Cost of goods, but it's bigger than that.
Yeah.
So that's just where I am mentally
yeah.
in my career. So,
I mean, this goes back to this place, right? Like, this kind of dovetails with a lot of stuff we've been talking about. Like, how do you look at what you do? You know, I never thought of this coming. This is, you know, I'm maybe 30 episodes into this show, but this thing comes up a lot, you know, like, what is cooking? You know, like, is it professional cooking? Is it an art? Is it a craft? Are you there? And we already kind of talked about, are you there for yourself or for the customer? We've decided it's kind of
but
both.
But it's a catch-all.
It all has to harmonize.
It's all that. You're an artist when you're putting your dining room together and you're sitting like, no, I want those colors. I want that type of lighting. I want this.
Yeah.
Okay, what plates you want? These are the plates I want. You're all of that.
Did you always want to have your own place? Like when you were young? Was that always kind of the end goal? Or is that something
you've come to
realize?
I used to say when I was a kid, this is funny. I look back and say this. I used to say, I'm going to be better than Emeril Lagasse.
But did you mean as a business person? Did you mean as a celebrity, or did you mean as a chef?
As a chef, like, because that was the only, like, at that time in
life.
You're watching him on TV, so
yeah.
that was the chef. Like,
that's right.
Like, you didn't, being better, what did I look back and laugh, like, what does that mean? Being a better business person? I hope somebody along the line will come and want to buy into the
right.
company that
yeah.
large.
Yeah, right.
But I'm not giving up
yeah, right.
my life
right.
to get that kind of money,
yeah,
you
yeah,
know?
Yeah, right.
And then you look back and say, oh, I did it too early in life. Like, those are hard moments in life,
yeah.
right? But he didn't know that the culinary world was going to be bigger than...
Him?
Bigger than what it was at that time.
No. Yeah.
He would have did it totally different.
Yeah. yeah. No, none of those guys saw it coming.
But no, you know, I would say my goal is to truly be able, you know, at the end of the day, the food is what makes you who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm fortunate to be able to do some TV things.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, when people watch you on TV, they still want to go and try your food. So if you don't have a place, it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Right. So you can be on TV, you can be projecting all these things. But if I can't see you, JJ, and I can't taste it, that doesn't help.
Yeah.
But
there are people who are happy with that.
And there are people that are happy with that,
you know,
yeah.
You did Rocco's show, right?
Right.
Okay, so Rocco, I was Rocco's publicist in another life. When
okay.
he was at Union Pacific, right? Rocco was like the flavor of the month. I mean, Rocco was the biggest thing in New
Rocco
York.
And
Rocco's been out of restaurants for years.
Rocco would have been one of the best chefs in the world right
yeah.
now.
Yeah, but he's fine.
Oh, he's perfect.
I mean,
he loves what he's
doing.
He told me he's good.
Yeah, he loves what he's doing, but that's not you.
Somebody asked me, are you taking the Rocco turn in life? And I said, no.
Yeah.
I need to be in a restaurant.
That's important to you for the long haul.
Yeah,
you want to be doing it as long as you physically, mentally, as long as you can kind of.
And hopefully I can build, do quick service, do full services.
Right.
You know, I feel like people crave my food.
Yeah.
Well, I know I can say that I know I can put butts in seats now ever since I did Chef's Club. That's something hard to say, you know. When I remember sitting down with the owner, he's like, you're going to have a full every night. I was like, I hope that. I hope you want to have a full. Like, you know.
Go ahead. Put me in, coach.
Hope so, but I can't sit here and say, yes, it's going to be full every night.
Yeah.
But if you want me to say that to make you feel better, no problem. But I was really lucky to have supporters and people that wanted to come eat my food and support. Yeah. So I'm thankful for that. Or I wouldn't be able to really do what I do.
Great. Well, I need to wrap this up because you need to be somewhere. We could talk all day. Again, the book is Between Harlem and Heaven. It's by J.J. Johnson and the great Alexander Smalls in collaboration with Veronica Chambers. And I highly recommend it. Obviously, I've read it, and I think you will enjoy it. And it was great to see you here, J.J. I hope to see you in a kitchen soon.
Yes, you will.
Okay.
I promise.
All right. Great talking to you.
Good talking to you, too.
And that's our show for this week. Caitlin, thank you as always for joining me. And J.J. Johnson, thank you for meeting me. Mermaid Inn, Danny Abrams, thank you for the location. That was great and much appreciated. You really helped us out. David Tatasciore, our engineer. Thank you, David, as always, for splicing these things together. And to all of you out there in podcast land, thank you, as always, for listening to the show. I hope you enjoyed this week's conversation. I'm sorry if I was a little down or a little scattered, but that's just where my life is right now. It shouldn't be this way for long, I hope. We're getting punchy, guys. Thanks for listening. Right. See you back here next week on Andrew Talks to Chefs. Even with scars.